From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's important for us to hear from people who have a front row seat to what's happening in their communities. Today we'll meet a citizen journalist who has put herself at risk to cover local politics.
He grabbed my arm and twisted it behind my back and frog marched me out of the rally. And he was especially violent in his arrest.
And we want to hear from you, especially if your neighborhood has recently played host to a movie project. We'll go on set in Georgia in just a moment, hear what's filming in our state. But if you had a celebrity sighting, maybe an opportunity to be an extra on a show, I know some of you have, we want to hear from you. Before all of that, though, it is the centennial year of the National Park Service. And our celebration includes a closer look at Georgia's parks and historic monuments. We highlighted two such sites on our show yesterday. We heard about Atlanta's Oakland Cemetery, where the Goat Man is buried. He's a little-known figure from Georgia's past. And then we stepped back in time to learn about Jekyll Island with the Time Travelers Camp. Here is camp counselor Haley Komarumi.
I remember last week they were building forts out of, like, plastic straws. They were able to build a big fort that they could fit into. And they were really enthusiastic. Like, a kid gets to build a fort, but before that, they were able to tour through the historic district and see a bunch of architectural designs. And they incorporated that into their forts that they were building.
Here are your first thoughts. Listener Terry Anulowicz, maybe? That's how we pronounce your name, Terry? Tweets this. It's important to note that while there are some very expensive camps, many, like scout camps, are a great option for many kids. Great point, Terry. And Sam Burnham suggests we check out the Chieftains Museum in Rome, Georgia, for our next historic sites feature. Thanks for the recommendation, as always, Sam. We'd love to get your thoughts. Is there a Georgia historic site or a park that we should take a look at? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. We're also on Twitter. It's at OSD Talk, or you can post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. On any given day, there's probably a film or TV crew at work somewhere in Georgia, but what are they working on? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
Made in Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies!
Let's go see the stars!
Reporter Jennifer Brett joins me yet again. She writes for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Buzz blog. Jennifer,
good morning.
Good to have you back.
Oh my goodness, so much filming going on this summer.
Is there? Or do you always say that?
Summertime, the filming is busy.
Okay, well, good. Let's start first with the first one you pointed out was Levy.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. Kate Mara is going to star as Megan Levy, who was stationed in Iraq. She was a canine handler. And so it's going to be a really interesting military-type drama.
Now, Kate Mara, many people know her because she played Zoe Barnes on the Netflix series House of Cards.
I took a chance, showed up at your house, and placed myself at your feet. Crossed ethical lines, professionally, physically, and I hold myself accountable for that. Those are my choices, and I can live with them.
So I didn't appreciate that role. It was yet another female reporter that sleeps with her source, but...
Yeah, that never happens, by the way.
It does not. But what makes you so excited about this particular film, Levy?
Well, it's about a very strong, powerful woman who has obviously gone through... It's based on a true story, has obviously gone through combat with her canine companion. So very much looking forward to seeing this one hit the big screen. Georgia is no stranger to military-type films. And Vin Diesel just the other day shouted out Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. This is coming up this fall in time for Veterans Day.
So speaking of Vin Diesel,
yes.
The Fast and Furious franchise just finished up the latest installment, Fast 8. Yes, I said 8. It's scheduled to come out next year, starring these two muscle-bound guys.
You do whatever it is you gotta do. When you find that sumbitch, just do me one favor.
What's that?
Don't miss.
That's Vin Diesel and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock.
Can we say some bitch on the radio?
Well, you just said it again.
Oh,
so if we
oops.
Couldn't, then you just made it twice as bad.
Shucks.
Okay, so this is the eighth
Octo
film?
Octofast, yes. They're back in action again. They're just going to keep driving this train. And you know who has signed on for the fun this time is Scott Eastwood, Clint Eastwood's son. He's joining the gang this year. It's obviously a huge ensemble cast. Scott Eastwood was spotted just the other day at the Chops Lobster Bar in Buckhead, enjoying a little downtime.
Okay, those movies are still making money, I guess? They
are printing money. What's really going to be interesting about Octofest, as I'm hoping that'll catch on, hashtag it, you heard it here first. What's interesting about this one is it filmed partly in Havana. And they early on in the filming process, they
Havana,
posted,
Cuba,
yes.
Where we recently opened
exactly. So, yeah, the diplomatic ties open, and the first thing we do is go down there and film a movie.
Why not?
Yeah.
Okay, two more movies just wrapped up production here in Atlanta. The first is Baby Driver, and this, I guess, the cast is all star.
Yeah. Speaking of House of Cards, Kevin Spacey stars in this one. Also stars Ansel Elgort. This is about a young getaway driver played by Ansel, who finds himself embroiled in a doomed heist. What was interesting about this one? Very conveniently, they came and filmed right around the corner from us at the AJC, which was nice of them, in the perimeter area. So it was fun to watch them in action for a day there as well.
And then there's another movie that I've not heard anything about called Hidden Figures.
This one is so interesting. This is also based on a true story, based on a nonfiction book by the same title. Hidden Figures is about African-American women who were integral in NASA's early space missions. Back in the day, you know, of course, laboring under the era of segregation, they were not able to you know, work alongside their counterparts, but they were very crucial and key into those early missions. Stars Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe, Kevin Costner plays
Taraji P. Henson.
Taraji P. Henson from Empire, and Kevin Costner plays the NASA, the head. So it's going to be interesting to see this come together. They filmed in a number of locations around the metro that look, you know, have that kind of old-timey look. So look for downtown Canton and parts of East Point.
And this book was a favorite among NPR listeners for sure as well. So that one's pretty following. Now, Snoop has complained. We've talked about this on the show. He complained that uplifting African-American stories rarely get produced. And he says Hollywood likes to focus on what he called black misery. So do we think of this movie, Hidden Figures, as something that might make Snoop Dogg happy?
I don't know if it's going to make Snoop Dogg happy. I'm not sure exactly what's going to make Snoop Dogg happy. I know he didn't like Roots very much. He posted that video kind of lashing out and just kind of giving his thoughts on it. So let's just hope for the best. He was in town not too long ago, by the way. Snoop Dogg was giving a private concert with T.I. over in the Buckhead area. So hopefully that made his day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is AJC reporter Jennifer Brett. We're talking about new productions, movie and film, that are underway or have been recently underway in the Peach State. And we want to hear from you. What upcoming movies are you looking forward to, if any? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation at Facebook. Okay, so speaking of what they hope to be a blockbuster, third time's a charm, right? Spider-Man. We had Tobey Maguire in the first series. There were three movies in that first series. Andrew Garfield came in the following two movies. I guess they were all too old because now Spider-Man's going to be played by the youngest actor yet. This is Tom Holland.
You're the Spiderling, crime-fighting spider. You're Spider-Boy?
Spider-Man.
Not in that onesie, you're not.
It's not a onesie.
Who else knows? Anybody?
Nobody.
Not even your unusually attractive aunt?
No. No, 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 no. If she knew, she would freak out.
Okay, so that is a scene from Captain America: Civil War. Tom Holland now is 20 years old. I think he was still a teenager when they began filming. What do we expect that's going to be different?
Well, he is here in the ATL right now. There was just kind of a Marvel handoff down at Pinewood. Guardians of the Galaxy
Wait,
2.
A Marvel handoff?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Guardians of the Galaxy 2 finished filming, and here comes Spider-Man. So passing the Marvel baton. James Gunn posted a really nice picture of himself with Tom Holland and Chris Pratt from Spider-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy. So really interested to see Spider-Man taking off. It's going to star Robert Downey Jr., who we just heard in that clip. And wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple other Marvel stars pop up. You know how they kind of just sort of add people as production goes along. So Marissa Tomei for sure will be back for this one. She is the foxy aunt.
Not
unusually
her first
rodeo
aunt.
In Atlanta. She was here years ago filming Parental Guidance with Billy Crystal and Bette Midler and took a real shine to Super Jenny, as I recall, back in the day. So we need to get the word out. Marissa, go to the Atlanta History Center. That's where Super Jenny is now. Welcome back to town.
Do you have a preference among all these three Spider-Men? Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield? I mean, you, Jennifer Brett.
You know, I think they all have their attributes. I'm not going to side with any one Spider-Man because I don't want your people to blow up your phones. But, you know, I always tell people whenever I'm covering an event, they always say, what's your favorite event to cover? I always say this one. And so I'm going to just side with all three equally.
All right. So one last thing. Let's talk about one last thing. Actor Wendell Pierce, a lot of people know him. He played Bunk, Detective Bunk on The Wire. In that show, he had a quick temper.
You know what they do to police in jail? pretty police like yourself. Motherfucker, we have kids, houses, car payments, furniture. Jimmy, I just bought brand new lawn chairs and a glass patio table. Now, you don't buy no like that if you're planning to lose your job and go to prison.
Okay. Last month, Wendell Pierce ended up behind bars. He allegedly assaulted a pair of Bernie Sanders supporters outside a hotel, and that was in downtown Atlanta. He's currently out on bond. He's shown aggressive support for Hillary Clinton, obviously, but he's here to work, not just...
Yeah, if you run into him, maybe you want to talk about something besides politics. He's, you know, a man of great passion, so, you know, you want to support that. But anyway, he is in town with, as you noted, Jeremy Smollett Bell, filming One Last Thing. Recently, he was in town starring as Clarence Thomas in the HBO film Confirmation, which was filmed here in Atlanta, also starred Kerry Washington as Anita Hill. So he's, you know, he's a great...
Confirmation hearings for Judge Thomas.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's interesting that amid news that, you know, what's going to happen with Clarence Thomas. So he's, you know, got this little film project to look at.
Little film project. Okay, let's talk about another film project. People may recognize this particular actor, but the thing about it, when the recent sightings of this particular actor had made people talk about, I guess, his size, his diet.
Liam Neeson was spotted in New York City's Soho District Monday, looking gaunt. The 63-year-old action star looks like he lost a staggering amount of weight, so much so that you almost can't recognize him.
Why has he lost so much weight?
Well, apparently he's been standing out in the sun here in Atlanta. Maybe he just melted right off of him. I think you could probably lose about 4 pounds in water weight if you stood outside today. He's been in town filming Felt. And what I love about this one is my colleague Bill Torpy stars right alongside Liam Neeson. And by stars right alongside him, I mean he was an extra in one scene, which is enough for me to declare Bill Torpy is just super famous now, right?
Yeah, I think that's enough.
Yeah,
this is
I'm claiming it.
Look, Liam Neeson has said that he's done with the Taken movies.
Oh, I hope so.
He's done other movies.
Wait, did that come out? Was that my anti-voice or my outside voice?
Look, he's done, Jennifer, other movies that aren't called Taken, but they're still the exact same Taken storyline. So please tell me Felt is not about someone
being...
No,
it takes place during the Watergate hearings and nobody gets kidnapped. But
okay, good.
What I do love about Liam Neeson and his Taken movies is he is just the man who launches 1,000 memes. Like, if you go on Giphy.com, you can find, like, 100 different ones of Liam Neeson talking about "I will find you and kill you," and
I so have if you're skills.
Yeah, if you're ever looking just to, you know, waste a little time on the internet, which I know can happen sometimes, Liam Neeson and his Taken trilogy are there for you.
Okay, so one last, we have about a minute left. So talk to me about Goosebumps 2, because I didn't realize Goosebumps 1.
Yeah, Goosebumps might be coming back to town. The Goosebumps filmed in Madison, Georgia, and in fact, you know, did really well. It came out last.
Did it?
Halloween.
I didn't know.
And they might be cranking back up again. I remember when I interviewed
Jack Black returns, maybe?
Yes, we'll see. I'm really looking forward to it. And what I loved about this movie is because, you know, coming down here to film a monster movie in the home of Walking Dead, they had the best, you know, costume and makeup artist possible. So they had some primo looking zombies. So I would not be surprised to see them come back around. If, you know, no spoiler alert, but it did kind of end on a little bit of a cliffhanger last time. So I don't know, maybe Goosebumps will come back our way.
Jennifer Brett, reporter for the Atlanta Journal Constitution, author of the AJC's Buzz Blog. Thanks as always, Jennifer.
See you next time.
This is On Second Thought. When national news breaks, you probably know where to turn, but local politics don't get a lot of coverage. Citizen journalist Nydia Tisdale has made it her mission to cover local government meetings across Georgia. She's posted more than 850 videos of public political events on YouTube. But Tisdale has had to fight along the way. She won a $200,000 lawsuit against the city of Cumming in 2012 after she was ejected from a city council meeting. And she's currently involved in another legal case after she was arrested at a Dawson County GOP rally in 2014. We asked her to stop by our studios and share her story.
Most people are delighted to see me and my camera when I attend events, particularly candidates, because I'm spreading their message in their own words. What better way to encourage voters to vote? Although there has been a few instances where I have met with some resistance to my video camera. On August 23rd, 2014, I attended a political campaign rally in Dawson County, And I brought my video camera to record candidates giving their stump speeches.
I'm going to turn it over to our insurance commissioner, Mr. Ralph Hudgens. We're really glad to have Commissioner Hudgens with us today. He's done a great job on the ballot this fall, and we'll let Commissioner Hudgens go from there. Thank you, sir.
And it included the entire slate of Republican candidates. I thought this would certainly be a public meeting of public interest. It was advertised in the local legal organ in print. It was advertised on social media. And I came with my camera and was just really delighted to be there to film their speeches, to get their message out to voters and to remind voters to cast their ballot. One particular candidate made some comment, and after his comment, he pointed at my camera and said, yes, I really did say that.
And that, and I thought I was going to have to resuscitate my wife. I thought she was going to pass out, and I thought I was going to absolutely puke listening to her. I mean, I don't know why you're videotaping, but yes, I said that.
And he was owning his statement, in my opinion. He was acknowledging that, yes, I know I'm on camera, I know I'm on film, I know I'm on the record, and yes, I really just said that. And it got a laugh, and then he left. He had another rally to attend, and that sparked a series of events that I don't think he ever anticipated, and that was Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens, who called my camera out. And there were several people who came and objected to me filming, and it eventually evolved to me being attacked physically by Captain Tony Wooten from the Dawson County Sheriff's Office and arrested and taken to the local jail.
What's your name, sir? Let go of me! I spoke with the owner prior to this event beginning. No, Mrs. Burtz, Kathy Burtz, said it was okay. Mr. Let go of me, sir.
I've been real nice. Now you're going to jail for resisting arrest. Do not stop.
He grabbed my arm and twisted it behind my back and frog marched me out of the rally. And he was especially violent in his arrest.
That hurts. You're hurting me.
Stop.
You're hurting me.
Stop.
You are really hurting me.
Stop.
We have sued Captain Tony Wooten and the other two officers who unlawfully arrested me, and that case is pending. And charges I am facing of criminal trespass and obstruction of an officer are also pending, so that's all in the courts today. The silver lining, if one can be drawn from all of this experience, is the educational opportunity for citizens and government alike to learn what our rights are, to learn what we can, and more importantly, what an officer cannot do, and that is violate our precious First Amendment right of free speech and freedom of the press. And that is sacred, especially to the media, because without that, we wouldn't have the country we have today.
Nydia Tisdale is a citizen journalist who covers Georgia politics. We also reached out to Dawson County officials and Tony Wooten for comment. As of the start of our show, we have not received a comment from either party. Nearly 6 million children around the world die each year before the age of 5. Why? A new initiative hopes to answer that question soon. It's called the Child Health and Mortality Prevention Surveillance Network. It's also called CHAMPS, which is way easier to say. The project is a collaboration between powerful research organizations that include the Emory Global Health Institute and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It will set up 6 surveillance sites over a 20-year span. The first 3 were recently announced: Mali, Mozambique, and South Africa. Here to tell us more is Tim Morris. He's the Chief Information Officer of CHAMPS. Hi, Tim.
Morning.
And also with us is Pratima Raghunathan. She's the Director of Science and the CDC lead for CHAMPS. Good morning, Pratima.
Good morning.
Tell me why Mali, Mozambique, and South Africa? Why these 3 to start with?
Yeah, these sites were chosen because they have very high under 5 mortality rates. And because...
What does very high mean?
Yeah, so in general, across the world, the median under 5 mortality rate is around 43 per 1,000 live births. That means that of every 1,000 children that are born, 43 of them might die before the age of five. And so in Mali and in Mozambique, it's around 70 or 90.
That's significantly higher.
It's much higher.
And, I mean, we do know what kills most young kids, right? So the certain diseases that are most likely to kill young kids?
Yes, we do. We know something about what kills young kids, but the information that we have is really based on models, on estimates that are coming from data that are based on interviews with parents after the children have died. And that's called a verbal autopsy.
Which is something I've never heard of. And let me take this to you, Tim, because what is a verbal autopsy?
So verbal autopsy would be, and this occurs, some of the other issues with data quality and specificity in the data is that the verbal autopsy might occur 1 to 4 months post-death for a child. So they go back, there's a standard form that typically may be changed a little bit within countries, but there's a form from the WHO that provides...
The World Health Organization
that provides a set of questions that ask some things about clinical information and other circumstances around the death. And then there's algorithms or review by local clinicians to determine some type of cause of death at some level of granularity.
But that doesn't sound very reliable.
It can be unreliable, and it's not very specific. You might have determined that maybe a child had pneumonia, but you don't know what the cause of that pneumonia was, what bug it was. Was it viral? Was it bacterial or some other cause? So I think what we're looking to do is to get to more specific causes of death to look for, you know, prevention. So you need a little more specificity.
Pratima, to just find out what's killing all millions of kids, that seems like a fairly simple thing. Let's just find out what killed them. But what complicates that, especially in these places, first three that you've chosen?
Yeah, it's because most children are not seeking medical care. Parents may not be able to bring their children to a health facility for various reasons. A lot of children are dying at home. In many of these countries, there's no death certification system or what we call vital registration. So there's no actual death certificate to say that the child has died. And so there's no statistics that we can look at within the country to know for sure how many children have died and what was the reason that they died. So there's a whole series of issues, a lot of them related to the strength of their health systems that result in children not being, in us not understanding how many children are dying exactly and why they're dying.
And we can't go in any steps further in terms of treating some of the things that are killing kids until we know what's killing them. Is that the premise?
That's exactly the premise.
Which brings me to you, Tim, because the strategy of figuring out how to do that and how to get reliable information must be an enormous task. I mean, even starting with just three sites, these are three relatively large places.
Right.
How do you do that? And I understand CHAMPS doesn't actually send its own people in. You rely on people on the ground in those nations.
Right. First of all, we're not doing surveillance across the entire country in any of these cases. There's a defined catchment area for where we will do the research, a defined population that has certain characteristics. So that limits it somewhat, but it's still no less a daunting task, given some of the technology challenges and other connectivity. You know, we think of bandwidth being ubiquitous here in the United States, and while there's good cellular coverage and some data coverage with 3G that's available there, it's still a challenge. But the good thing about the sites that we're working with in the beginning, they're very capable sites with research principal investigators that are very experienced, and they have pretty good infrastructure in place. Now, that's why we're going to provide them the standards and the specifications of here's how we would like this to be done, how the data to be collected and managed. And they're going to use, for the most part, their own existing systems. And we'll fill gaps with systems where they might have a gap. Once we get past, start moving through additional sites in the future, that will not be the case as much, and we may have to provide more infrastructure. But the good thing about it is we'll do a lot of learning through these first set of sites to understand how we might need to support relative to infrastructure and connectivity and other types of things.
It's very complicated. My guests are Tim Morris, CHAMP's Chief Information Officer, and Pratima Raghunathan. She is the Director of Science and the CDC lead for CHAMPS. You were just in Mali last week, is that right, Pratima?
Yes, I was.
And you interacted with at least one of the communities that CHAMPS will be studying.
That's right. So I was working with our colleagues in Mali, the Center for Vaccine Development, and we're very interested in working, first of all, before we even approach parents at this very terrible, tragic time, at the time of a child's death, we want to understand what communities think about child health and well-being, and we want to understand the relationship between the CHAMPS procedures and what the priorities of the communities are themselves. So
help me understand what that means. Mm-hmm. The difference between CHAMPS procedures mm-hmm. and the priorities of the community. What does that mean?
So we are seeking to get information about child deaths in a community, and that's a pretty sensitive topic. So we want to make sure that we're approaching people respectfully about this issue, and we don't want to create misperceptions about what we're doing.
Because of cultural differences.
Of course. And also because even if we were to do this in the United States, we'd want to make sure we were doing this appropriately. And there's many diverse responses to this. So we're working in every country. We have teams of anthropologists and social behavioral scientists who are starting to work with communities to help them tell us what it is, what child health means to them, and what they think about child death. And what was really striking, I think, in our discussions with these community leaders was they thought many children were dying in their communities and they didn't know why. And they were actually very interested in having CHAMPS work with them.
So, Tim, many people listening may think, oh, wow, that's terrible what happens in other countries. But the fact is, America has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the developed world. What kind of data can we bring back as CHAMPS proceeds that can help even developed nations with their infant mortality rates?
That's a good question. I think that when we look at the way we analyze some of this data, the way we collect the data certainly has broader implications across the developing world. I think there may be some way to project some of that, you know, in the more developed the world. But, you know, I don't know, Pratima, what do you think about that question? It's an interesting question.
It's a really interesting question, and it is a difficult one. I think, as Tim said, because the rates of infant and child mortality are so much greater in the developing world, probably most of the information we get will be mostly applicable in those settings. And as I said, the disparities are really quite great. We're talking about tenfold differences in the likelihood of a child dying or living between, you know, the developed world and the developing world. So I think it will help, hopefully, provide information to those communities themselves and to those countries. And we're working closely with ministries of health and scientific investigators and what we call national public health institutes as well to make sure that the information we're generating will actually be used by those countries.
Why does it take 20 years, Tim, to gather all this data that you need?
So I think, first of all, I think it may not take 20 years to have the number of sites that may be projected 20 to 25, but it will take some time because the later sites, when we get past the ones where we have very, you know, capable research infrastructure already in place, it will take more time to put those in place. But as well, even with a site that starts today, when you look at population data on populations and being able to apply that from an epidemiologic perspective for prevention strategies and other things at a national level, I think you need longer times, longer amounts of
more generations
of,
kids growing up and becoming adults and having babies?
Well, as well, to just have the numbers, because, you know, we are working within a portion of a catchment within a country. So how do you project that to a national population, and how do you look at that across you know, even regionally. So I think that you need to have that experience in numbers of cases to be able to do some of those projections. And again, Pratima can probably add some to that as well.
Well, Tim Morris is the Chief Information Officer of CHAMPS. We're out of time for the conversation, although it is fascinating and will continue for the years ahead. Pratima Raghunathan is the Director of Science and the CDC lead for CHAMPS. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. If some of history's greatest artists could go back in time and redo their work, would they? Would Michelangelo maybe use different colors in the Sistine Chapel, or would Beethoven change a couple notes in the Fifth Symphony? My next guest has spent the last 20 years agonizing over her masterpiece. Karen Hall released her debut novel, Dark Debts, in 1996. It told the story of a Georgia family tormented by the devil, and it was an instant success. Most best-selling authors would move on, applaud their own success, and write, start on the next book. Karen Hall did not do that. She says she couldn't. Dark Debts has continued to capture her imagination all these years later, and now the story is getting a new life. Dark Debts has been re-released with some major plot changes and a new ending. Karen Hall joins us this morning from the studios of WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. Karen, it's a pleasure.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, I mean, the first question everyone must ask you is what was it about the original version of the novel that you couldn't let go of?
There were several things, and one was just the protagonist was not done with me. So whenever I try to write something else, I just kept hearing his voice. But pragmatically, I just knew that I had become a better writer, and I wanted to make the book better. And there was also the fact that when I wrote the book, I had converted to Catholicism not long before the book came out. And so my take on it was really simplistic. And as I learned more and knew that more, I felt bad about it. And I wanted to be able to go back and, you know, I can't do it justice in terms of how complicated it is, but I wanted to be able to show a broader view.
You also took, in the new version, it's a little less gory. You took out a particular killing spree. I'm trying to be very careful and not give anything away either about the original version or the new version. But you did choose to take out some fairly violent scenes. Why?
You know, I took out the really gory scene because I just didn't feel like I needed it. And I guess the first time around I thought I did. But it just seemed to me that what was going on really had more to do with the main characters and what was going on inside them. And also I had had some complaints from people who didn't like the fact that one of the protagonists basically got away with murder, you know, by saying the devil did it. And I didn't know how I felt about that. So I thought since I didn't need it, I would just take it out.
Okay. So your sister is a novelist as well. She's published 11 books.
I think so.
You
I stopped counting at some point.
So. I went in and counted for you.
Okay, Karen. Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Come to Thanksgiving dinner at my house.
I'm not a bad mediator if there's arguments, but you spent 25 years, which is a quarter of a century, on this one novel. Is this something that you talk about with your sister?
Not really. I talked to her about it a lot when I wrote it the first time, and I talked to her about it so much that she finally wouldn't talk to me about it anymore. And,
really?
And yeah, she said, shut up and write the thing. So that actually was the best advice anybody ever gave me. So I shut up and wrote it.
So your sister is Barbara Hall.
Yes.
And she is not just a novelist, but she, like you, is also a writer for TV. And I found it interesting, and please do tell me if this is not accurate. But from what I understand, when you were quite young, you were kind of, sort of, in a way, discovered by Alan Alda?
I was in college, and I took a summer school class and went out to California, and we met with various people, and he was one of the people that we met with. And I remember I told him that I was missing a premiere of a play I'd written that my community theater was doing so that I could go out there to meet him. And so he asked me to send him the play, so I did. And then he actually called me at my sorority house, which was interesting because nobody believed that it was really him. And I think the person who answered said, yeah, and I'm Robert Redford. But he called me and said that he really liked it and he'd like me to keep sending him what I wrote. So I did. And then at a certain point, he said, I've talked to my agents and they say you really have to live out here if you want to do this. And so I picked up and moved. And then after I had been out there doing typing and filing stuff for 11 months, he called me and said that MASH was looking to hire a new staff writer and he wanted them to hire a woman. So he got me an interview and I got the job.
And I wonder what you think that change, how that helped your evolution as a writer, to have one of your first professional jobs as a writer be MASH.
It was overwhelming. And in fact, when my agent called to tell me they wanted to interview me for the job, I tried to turn it down because I said, it's MASH, you know, they'll fire me in 6 weeks. Because I can't do that. And so he said, well, if they fire you in 6 weeks, you'll live off of it forever. So he made me take the job, and I ended up staying there till the end of the show.
And you've written for all kinds of other TV shows, Hill Street Blues, Moonlighting, Roseanne. You've written episodes for Judging Amy and The Good Wife. Does writing TV shows help you or hurt you when it comes time to sit down and write a novel?
I feel like it helps me. You know, there are things that it helped and things that it didn't. It was interesting to me to not have people giving me notes because I'm so used to that. I'm used to writing, you know, with restrictions and with trying to match what somebody needs because it's a commercial art. And so is writing a book, but it wasn't so much like that. And my editor would give me notes, and if I didn't like his idea, he would say, okay, it's your book. And that never happens in television. So I liked the freedom of it. But I kind of, especially when I was writing this current edition, I didn't like the fact
current edition of Dark Debts.
Right. And I didn't like the fact that the only limits I really had were the limits of my own ability. And that's something that, you know, I don't want to spend every day of my life bumping up against. You know, this time I knew that this would be it. I'm not going to rewrite it again in 20 years. And so, you know, it could only be as good as I could make it. And that was scary.
Okay, so then tell me about when you very first began to write this novel. What would be your first and until now only novel? Why this subject matter? And I wonder, you were doing so much writing for other things, for other people's storylines. How did you land on this subject?
I had a friend whose mother was convinced that there was a demonic curse on their family, and I thought she had a case that would hold up in court because I knew details about the family. And I just thought that would be an interesting thing to look at. I thought, you know, could you make an intelligent case for that? And that's where I started.
And you ended up with what became a bestseller. What was that like the first time around? Did you feel before it went to the printing press that the book, that you were finished with it, that you were happy with it?
No, actually, because I wrote myself into a corner because I knew that if the book had lasted for a few more days, that my protagonist would have made a different decision. But I had written him as someone who didn't learn fast and wasn't going to turn on a dime. So I was kind of stuck with where he ended up at the end of the book. But what I thought at the time was I'll write a sequel and I'll finish it. And then I tried to write a sequel, and I have a file drawer full of chapter ones for the sequel, but it just never went anywhere. And then when I got a chance to rewrite it, I could do what I wanted to with that character.
So then that begs the question, if now you think you could. I mean, have you exercised your demons, pardon the pun?
With this novel?
Yeah.
I think so. It's not on my mind like it used to be. And I feel pretty good about where I left it.
You changed the whole ending.
I did.
Don't tell us what it is.
I won't tell you the ending, but I'll tell you that part of the reason I changed it, I never quite felt right about it, but the main reason I changed it was because the ending was very internal in the book the first time, and it was in the characters' minds, and, you know, I'm always now writing with the idea of this could be a movie, too, so I knew I had to do something to fix the fact that the ending wasn't too internal. So I went back and wrote something that you could film.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Hall. She's the author of the novel Dark Debts. The book came out 20 years ago. It was a bestseller, but Karen has rewritten it and released a new version. Now, you just said that you don't think about the novel now as much as you used to. What has that been like for 20 years? How often did you think about this novel?
Way too often, and it was really distracting because I had other ideas for novels that I wanted to write, and I just could not get that one out of my head.
But what was that like when you sat down to write something else? What would happen?
It's hard to say. It wasn't so much when I sat down. It was just that the character would just pop into my head all the time. And usually when I write a character, by the time I'm finished with the project, I'm done with that character. So, you know, he kept coming back to me, and, you know, I felt kind of haunted by the character.
And so that is not happening anymore?
No.
Have you sat down to write since
then?
Well,
I'm writing a lot of things right now, but they're all television and movies. I'm too busy right now to think about writing another novel, but I think when I do sit down to do it again, my head will be clear.
Because it sounds like you already feel like it's clearer.
I do.
Do you feel as though the next book might be your sequel at last, or are you going to move on?
Oh, no. I'm not going to write a sequel. I'm done with these people. So I'm going to move on and write something else.
So before you're done with them, let me ask you a little bit about the extra research you did for this book in particular. Because as I understand it, you came to Georgia and spent quite a bit of time here.
I actually bought a house here. I bought a farm in Polk County near Rome, and I always, while I'm writing for television, I always try to have a place that is somewhere else in what I think of as normal territory, because LA is just its own thing, and especially in the Southeast, because that's where I came from and that's what I love. And I set the book in Atlanta because I'd never been to Atlanta, and I knew I'd have to go to the place where I set the book, and I wanted to go to Atlanta. So I ended up falling in love with it and buying a farm, which I had for many years.
And you spent some time with some death row inmates. Why?
I did. Well, the person who gave me the idea, whose mother gave me the idea for the book, had a brother who had been executed. And I wanted to make sure the character was more a composite character. And so I wanted to meet other families of people with relatives on death row. And so that's what I did. And I spent time talking to the person because I also had to be able to understand to write the criminal.
And can you tell me what that conversation was like with the publisher? Because I understand it. The publisher came to you and said, hey, let's reissue this book.
Well, my publisher is John Karp, who published the first edition at Random House, and then this edition is at Simon & Schuster. And he had mentioned to me somewhere in the last 20 years that he had always wanted to take a book that a writer had written and let them go back and rewrite it many years later to see how it would change. And when he said that, it stuck in my mind, and I didn't think, let's do my book, but I thought that was an interesting concept. So I actually had someone was trying to buy the rights to the book to do an audio drama, and it looked like it was going forward. It actually didn't, but I called John and said, this is happening, so you might want to, release the book again. And so we realized that it would be the 20th anniversary, and so I said, you know that thing you said about you would like to have somebody go back and rewrite their book? Could that be me? And he said, yes.
Are you prepared for readers to say they liked the first version better?
I don't have a problem with that. And the thing about a book, because I also owned a bookstore until very recently, and the thing about a book is, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. some people are going to prefer the first book and some people are going to prefer the second. And when I give them out now, I kind of explain to them what the differences are to see which one they want.
And is it now okay for you to talk to your sister Barbara about Dark Debts?
About the book? I don't know. I don't think we really have anything else to say about it. I talk to her mostly about show business and how to survive it.
Oh, so you don't actually need a mediator at Thanksgiving dinner anymore?
No, we don't really.
Okay, so is this going to be the habit, Karen, except for TV work, when you sit down to write stuff, are you going to be a chronic rewriter?
Oh, I am a chronic rewriter. And
already,
when it's television, you know, I rewrite until they wrench it out of my hands because they have to shoot it. Because I'm just a perfectionist and I never stop working on it.
So that might happen with your next novel also?
It might, but I'm going to try to, in this rewrite, I try to not be like that because I just get so bogged down in it.
Well, good luck with your next book.
Thank you.
Whenever you can start that. What TV and movie projects are you working on? Can you tell me?
Not really. I'm working on a screenplay that's based on a woman's real life story, and I'm working on a miniseries that I can tell you that is based on the unsaintly years of St. Ignatius, which were very unsaintly. And then I'm working on a TV project that I can't talk about, but it will be high profile, so you'll see it if it comes to fruition.
Well, she has been nominated for an Emmy 7 times, so she knows what she's doing. Karen Hall just re-released her novel, Dark Debts, New Characters, A New Ending. Karen, thank you so much. And you know what? Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's our show for today. And we wanted... Is there something in your life that you've always wanted to go back and do over? Maybe it wasn't a novel. Maybe it was a decorating project or an essay or a conversation. That's common. What would you redo if you could? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can leave a message there. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, "Devil, just come on back if you ever want."